Guardian Unlimited.
I'm James Randerson, and this is Science Weekly for December the 3rd. Time is of the essence this week. In scientific mysteries, from the extinction of the dinosaurs to the authentication of the Turin Shroud, dating objects accurately is often central to the solution. Geologist Chris Turney is here to tell us more. The UN's climate summit in Bali kicks off this week. A lot of hot air will be generated, but will it actually make any difference to the climate? And we hear how scientists have restored the sensation of touch to a woman with a prosthetic arm. Plus, there's the secret of young-looking skin and the story of a whiz kid, Mr. Big, botnet master at the centre of an alleged international crime ring. Now, I'm not sure what that means either, but I'm sure Bobby will enlighten us. This is Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. Alok's still on the run this week, but the rest of the Science Weekly team have electronic tags around their ankles, so they're not allowed to leave Guardian Towers. Our very own whiz kid, Mr. Big, is tech correspondent Bobby Johnson.
Konnichiwa.
And a man not in need of the secrets of young-looking skin is the baby-faced Ian Sample.
Hello, and thanks, James, for coming to my 92nd birthday.
Our special guest this week is Dr. Chris Turney, who's made the long trek up from Exeter to see us.
Hi, James.
Thanks for joining us. More from Chris anon, but first... Now, don't worry, Science Weekly hasn't suddenly found God, unless, of course, you count his noodliness, the flying spaghetti monster. No, that was the characteristically tenuous musical intro to a murky religious detective story about a very special piece of linen cloth. Well, special, at least, until it turned out to be a fake. The Turin Shroud, with its enigmatic imprint of a bearded man, had attracted Christian pilgrims for centuries. To them, it was an object that had actually been in contact with Jesus himself. But in 1989, a new method of carbon dating showed that it was not 2,000 years old, but in fact dated from the 14th century. The tale is just one of a string of scientific mysteries in Chris Turney's book, Bones, Rocks and Stars, which all revolve around time and dating. Chris, thanks again for joining us. Why is it that dating is so important?
Basically, it gives us a perspective, James, on the past. We seem to just pluck numbers out of the air when it comes to dating a past. And what I wanted to do is try to explain how we get these numbers in Bones, Rocks and Stars.
So tell us a bit more about the Turin Shroud.
The Turin Shroud's a fun one because whenever you say, are you interested in dating a past, or you research it. And especially when you talk about carbon dating, people have been arguing about it and there's been pseudoscience done for years. I mean, basically, it was first known about historically in about the mid-14th century. It was Geoffrey de Charny. He was a French knight. And it was apparently in his belongings. And he died in the Battle of Poitiers. And his widow found this and started showing it to the local church. And people started flocking to it.
Probably made a couple of quid out of it.
Quite a bit of money changed hands, I think. But some of the local bishops weren't that convinced either and complained. But they were told to shut up. And eventually it got moved around Europe until eventually it ended up in Turin. The ideal thing would be to actually carbon date it, measure how much radioactive carbon is in there. But in the old days, we'd need a shovel load of carbon before we could get a date. So you'd end up basically destroying a shroud to get a number. So it just wasn't viable. And then in the 70s, there was new developments. And essentially, we could move down to milligram sizes of samples. And so a protocol was set up. Three separate labs were invited to date the Turin Shroud. And they came up with an age that was identical, which showed it was a mid-14th century. And Geoffrey de Charny probably had a fake on his hands, so he probably wasn't as chivalrous as we thought.
Is the idea that he was probably the perpetrator of the fake?
Well, I'm not sure, actually, whether he actually did do it, but or if he got someone else to do it. But it's not 2,000 years old, anyway.
Another scientific mystery that you were very closely involved with was The Hobbit. Tell us a bit about that. I mean, we've talked about this on the podcast before. Of course, the Homo floresiensis that was found on Flores a few years ago and turned out to be another species of human that was around very, very recently. So obviously, the dating was crucial, but how did it all come about?
Oh, that was great fun. I should really retire now because it's not going to get any better than that. But what we were interested in was the route of migration of people into Australia. The majority of scientists believe that our species evolved in Africa around 200,000 years ago and migrated out. And they turned up in Australia about 60,000 years. So the most obvious route, if you had GPS and satellite images, is you'd actually go down through Indonesia and jump ship across a few of the islands and get across to Australia. A team was set up and the team were excavating archaeological sites across both sides of Indonesia. In 2003, Mike emailed me and said, oh gosh, we've discovered this small, 1 metre tall individual. It's got a small head. It's got a brain the size of a chimpanzee. But it's an adult. Its molar teeth have erupted. So he said, do you want to date it? And I started processing as quickly as I could. It seemed to suggest that the species looked incredibly ancient. It had some really bizarre, very ancient traits that were reminiscent of the earliest species of human going back 2 million years plus. So I thought, oh gosh, if radioactive carbon can only go back 60,000 years, there's not much chance of getting a date. And then I was at a conference in North Wales, in Bangor, and this email came through from Australia with the actual numbers, and it blew me away. I woke up when I realised that the actual individual was around 18,000 years ago, and the last of the species was around 13,000 years ago. And I was doing field work up in tropical Queensland at the time. And my wife, Annette, called me friends. She said, they talked about the Hobbit on the radio. And then 2 minutes later, the phone rings and it says, hello, mate, this is a radio show in Melbourne. Would you like to come on the breakfast show? And I said, well, we're not supposed to talk to anyone about this. And he said, well, I don't want to disappoint you, mate, but it's on the front page of The Age, which is like a major paper down there.
Ian's got a question.
No, I was just interested in how precisely you can date something using carbon dating.
It depends on how old it is, actually. As you go further and further back, the ages blow out, so maybe 30, 40,000 years, you know, maybe uncertainty of about 500. But because of these wonderful nuclear bomb tests we did in the 60s, you can date some of the stuff in the last few decades to within a year with it.
Intriguing stuff, Bobby.
I was just wondering, we're watching TV and there's a reconstruction or there's a drama in which somebody does a bit of carbon dating and they do it in, 10 seconds flat and here are the results. And, somebody gets banged up. how long does it take to carbon date something?
Actually, it's not quite as quick as 10 seconds. If you're really pushed, you could probably chemically pre-treat a sample a day. And if you were really lucky, turn it to carbon. You could probably get a date in about 3 days if you really pushed it with a lot of money.
I'm still not sure that would make CSI, though.
Thanks very much, Chris. Thanks very much for that. If you want to know more about how archaeologists tell the time, his book Bones, Rocks and Stars is published by Macmillan. I'm James Randerson, and you're listening to Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. Still to come...
In some ways, you could portray it as humankind's last chance to deal with potentially the biggest threat we've ever faced in the history of civilised societies.
The head of Friends of the Earth tells us what he wants to see from the Bali climate talks. But now it's time for our roundup of the science news that's been making the headlines over the past 7 days. This is your News Jack.
Sir David King, the outgoing chief scientific advisor to the UK government, has urged Gordon Brown to extend nuclear power and bring back GM crops. In a speech last week, he said both were crucial for fighting climate change and feeding a growing population.
Scientists have found a way to reverse the ageing process in skin, restoring it to a thicker, more youthful state in just 2 weeks. The advance, which works by manipulating a master control gene, has so far been demonstrated only in mice. But researchers hope it could be used in patients to speed up recovery from injury.
A pioneering operation on a woman who lost her arm in a motorcycling accident has allowed her to experience the sensations of touch, heat and pain in her prosthetic replacement. The operation, which was carried out by researchers in Chicago, involved rerouting nerves from her lost limb to her chest.
And finally, he's the Mr. Big at the heart of a $20 million global internet crime web. His gang of hackers stole credit card information, manipulated stock trade, and crashed computer networks. But when the FBI finally caught up with him at his home in New Zealand, Akil, as he calls himself, turned out to be just 18 years old. The teenager now faces further questioning by police.
And that was your News Jam. Yeah! Thanks, Ian and Bobby. Ian, first to this rerouting of nerves business. I don't quite understand. Can you explain?
Quite a tricky procedure, really. It's called targeted innovation. And this group, they're led by Todd Kaiken at the Rehabilitation Institute in Chicago. Essentially, it's a military-funded project to help prosthetics, develop prosthetics, a new advanced prosthetic for soldiers and such like injured in the field. The first bit of work they did was they rerouted nerves from the remains, basically, of the limb, just above the shoulder or such like. They used certain nerves to help control a prosthetic arm, so its movement. What happened last week was a bit of work which allows someone to feel through a prosthetic arm. So obviously this is an enormous advance for prosthetic arms because it means that instead of when you want to go and pick something up and close your hand around it, you don't need to watch it. You can actually feel what you're doing and just operate how the rest of us do. The way they did it was they took some nerves from the remainder of the arm and they transferred them over to the chest. What you can then do is you can wire in the prosthetic arm. So when you tap on the fingers, when you move the fingers, it then activates these nerves which are now in the chest, but it makes the person feel as if they can sense it with their hand, even
so
though the
brain sort of fills in the gaps.
Yeah, because the nerve endings from the nerves you know, ultimately go to the brain are still there. They just don't go to the arm because the arm is now missing. But you can still activate those nerves if you spread them out widely enough and you reinnervate the chest. You can still push on those, and as well as feeling pressure on your chest, you'll feel pressure and the sense of touch and heat and such like in the hand you no longer have.
Oh, amazing stuff, Bobby. On to you. Now, this, I don't know whether this computer whiz is one of your protégés. Why isn't he out, you know, chasing girls and experimenting with drugs like normal 18-year-olds?
Well, first of all, he might well be. I don't know. And we do have to point out that at the time of recording, all of this is alleged. He's been arrested, but no charges yet. So you know, no, we're not talking specifics here, anybody. The reason people do this is because there's tons of money in it. I mean, yeah. So what they do is get viruses planted on computers around the world. It's pretty easy to propagate a virus or a worm and get people to mistakenly allow it onto their machine. And what that does then is opens a back door to the hacker who can take information off that computer if they want. And in this case, it's alleged that he was taking credit card information and other personal details. But also, and probably kind of more importantly, on a larger scale, they can also group these compromised computers all together into what's called a botnet, which is just a robot network. They're computers controlled by a central operator. And what they then do is use these to attack specific targets. Governments are one example, or perhaps e-commerce websites or banks. And basically what you do is if you've got a million computers that you can control, you point them all at the same place at the same time, and the network that you're targeting just collapses under the weight of traffic. And so they can use that to blackmail or just to cause destruction.
Ian, you've got a question?
This was, what, a $20 million establishment that this guy set up? I mean, when the police went to arrest him, did they approach this palace and sort of like, we've come to ask you a few questions about your finances? I mean, what's he done with the money, or is he still living at home with his parents?
That would have given the game away, really, wouldn't it? If they had to catch him as he flew into his helipad or something. You know, the details are pretty sketchy at the moment, and for legal reasons, we can't go into...
We don't even know his name, do we? Then?
Well, we can't talk about his name for fear of prejudicing anything. International law, you know what it's like. He was part of a network of people, so the entire operation was valued at $20 million. But actually, the FBI said last year that they were chasing and they were cracking down on this kind of shadowy gang that they'd been looking for. And so this is the highest profile arrest they've made as part of this kind of ongoing sweep. I suppose the details will all come out and we'll find out that he's been bathing in ass's milk and, you know, and being seen to by young virgins or something.
Please stop there.
Very expensive, isn't it?
Yeah. Bobby, you're letting your imagination get away with you. And who knows, maybe there's a Mr. Bigger out there. But anyway, Ian, tell us more about Sir David King's valedictory farewell.
Yeah, he vacates the post very soon. This is the British government's chief scientific advisor. He gave a speech at the Royal Society last week just saying goodbye, so long, farewell. And he used the opportunity to talk about the need for nuclear power if we are going to meet our carbon reductions targets. And also, interestingly, he talked about the need to bring back GM, which he said we absolutely need. He said it was crucial for a green revolution that is capable of feeding the world, which is one of the strongest things I've heard him say about agricultural biotech.
The nuclear power side of things he's talked about a lot before, but GM crops is an interesting one. Do you have any thoughts on that, Chris?
There always seems to be this really long target, 2050 or whatever, for reducing CO2 or carbon dioxide. And when you actually look at the evidence, that's far too long a time scale. We've got to get stuff down in the next 5 years, possibly less. And nuclear power stations, well, they take a hell of a long time to build, and they take a hell of a long time to get permission to actually build them in the first place. I think it's a bit of a long shot, personally. The technology's out there. We could just do it now. We almost need a Marshall Plan, really.
Ian.
I just wanted to mention something else that came up in his speech, very, very, you know, very near the end of his speech. And it wasn't, as far as I'm aware, picked up by anybody in the press. But he actually laid into scientific illiteracy in the government. And he said that we can't have the situation where there are civil servants advising ministers who second guess what the minister wants and then cherry pick scientific information to support that view, which I thought was a really significant thing to say.
Was he suggesting that's what happens, that sort of modus operandi in government?
This is. I think it was very delicately worded and couched, but he's, you know, for a man to stand up and say we must not allow civil servants to be doing this, suggested that they were doing it, or that he certainly suspected that they were doing it. And I thought that was really staggering. Certainly sort of one-on-one, he talks very much about his concerns over the absolute lack of basic scientific knowledge among many people who aren't in terribly junior positions in the civil service. And I thought that was just quite an interesting sort of swipe as he left.
Well, maybe when you're out on your arduous flight to Cape Canaveral next week, you could write us a little blog about that or something. only if you've got time, though. Thanks for that, everyone. If you'd like your say out there on any of these topics or anything in the show, please head to the blog and leave us your thoughts. And in our Christmas Eve show, we'll be looking back over the year and picking out some choice clips from Science Weekly 2007. If you've got any favourite moments from the past year that you'd like to hear again, or maybe a few that you'd really not like to hear again, please let us know. The blog and Science Weekly's Facebook wall are also waiting.
The time has come to stop looking back at the Kyoto Protocol. The time has come to stop looking back in blame or suspicion. The consequences of global climate change are so pressing that it doesn't matter who was responsible of the past. What matters is who is answerable for the future, and that means all of us. The rich nations and the poor nations have different responsibilities, but one responsibility we all have, and that is action. Action, action, action. The current stalemate between the developed and the developing worlds must be broken. It is time to come together in a new international agreement. They can be embraced by rich and poor nations alike.
That was the Governator telling delegates at the UN in September why this week's UN Conference on Climate Change in Bali is so important. It will set the framework for global efforts to fight climate change in the coming years, and crucially begin setting up a successor to the Kyoto Protocol. Earlier, I spoke to the head of Friends of the Earth, Tony Juniper, and asked him why it's so urgent.
The urgency really couldn't be overstated, because the longer we leave this, the more difficult it will become to solve the problem, and the higher the risks will be and the higher the costs will be going into the future. And so the Bali summit, really, in some ways you could portray it as humankind's last chance to deal with potentially the biggest threat we've ever faced in the history of civilized societies.
Already it feels like there's a change in the dynamic here. I mean, a couple of days ago there was the announcement of these 150 major world companies, including things like Coca-Cola, coming out and saying, we want a lead from government, we want legally binding targets so we can plan our investment in the future. What's going on?
For many years, we've had companies and company lobby groups calling for voluntary approaches to tackling global warming. The argument has been that if customers want low-carbon products, they'll buy them. Leave it to the market, leave it to the innovation and creativity of companies was the line, and we can get to a low-carbon future using technology and free market instruments. that's obviously absolute rubbish in the real world. Some companies will do a bit of the right thing. Most companies won't. And finally, the penny has dropped in boardrooms worldwide.
They're asking governments effectively to level the playing field.
Exactly. They're asking the governments to put in place a level playing field, but a higher one and a greener one. And this is something that Friends of the Earth, we've been calling for years. And so we very much welcome, particularly the Prince of Wales initiative, to pull those many, many companies together from across the world and to send this very strong political signal.
So what can we reasonably expect from this summit? Because previous summits, you know, there's been a lot of expectation, but quite often when it comes down to the nitty-gritty, one or two very powerful countries effectively block, you know, major changes.
I don't think we will get the deal in Bali, but what we will get, hopefully, is the outline of what the deal could look like. So a rough global reduction target, and then negotiations over the next couple of years. In that period, governments then putting the flesh on those broad commitments. That's what Bali needs to say. If we get that, then I think it will be a good outcome. Now, some countries, the United States remains a major problem, although happily the outcome of the Australian elections is going to be a major boost. The United States now is really isolated. All they've got there now with them really is the Saudis, and between them they look like a really motley crew now in terms of the arguments they'll be putting across. And I think the Bush administration will become even more of a global laughing stock. We saw this in Montreal a little, with Bush administration's officials really struggling to hold any credibility at all with anybody. But I think it is only a question of time, and President Bush will leave office relatively soon. Hopefully the effect of the American delegation won't hold up the rest of the world moving forward. And indeed, since the Americans didn't sign the Kyoto Protocol, they actually have no negotiating power in there.
And just finally, even to those who are supporters of this process and would like to see progress in Bali, there may be some discomfort at the idea of 10,000 people flying to Bali in order to have this meeting. Is this really the only way of doing this? Would it be possible to achieve the sort of results that we want without perhaps this being such a massive kind of jamboree?
They sound glamorous, and Bali sounds glamorous. These meetings are actually very grinding. And given the very high stakes of all of this, it's unsurprising that these meetings are attracting increasingly large numbers of people going to them. The meeting is trying to solve the biggest challenge ever faced by humankind. And I think 10,000 people out of a global population of 6.5 billion actually is a relatively small number. Undoubtedly, there will be a massive environmental impact from that number of people flying there. A large amount of carbon will be emitted. A lot of stuff will be used up during the course of the meeting. But I think if one looks at the forward challenges during the course of the 21st century and the need to get some political agreement to deal with them, I think it is a small price to pay, considering what will be the price if we don't get an agreement.
I'm joined by David Adam, the Guardian's environment correspondent, who'll be one of those 10,000 poor souls who'll be at the grinding meeting this week. David, what can we expect from the meeting?
I think, as Tony was saying, this isn't going to produce the deal. As much as the politicians talk about the urgency of the problem, global negotiations do not work that quickly, unfortunately. What people are talking about is getting a deal in maybe 2009, perhaps 2010. Essentially, this is the first of three annual meetings with lots of side events in between. By the end of that 3 years, they have to thrash out that agreement. So this is the start of that process.
And we heard Tony there putting the boot into the Bush administration and saying that, you know, he's becoming the laughing stock of the world. But much as the environmentalists are looking forward to the day when he leaves office, which is sort of rapidly approaching, he's still obviously a very, very powerful man.
Well, unfortunately, he's the only man that counts when it comes to this meeting and the US approach. There'll be all sorts of Senate delegations there. Al Gore will be there taking a different line. But the only line the US will negotiate on is the Bush line. It's tempting to think of them as an irrelevant, that you can just sideline them until 2008 or 2009 when the replacement comes in. But that kind of ignores the really important dynamic that there is between the US and China. If we want to get China in this, the developed world has to be seen to be doing something, and that includes the US.
Hi folks, this is Brian May. You're listening to Science Weekly on Guardian Unlimited.
A quiet week on the blog this week, but one listener objected to our discussion of homeopathy in last week's show. It's a sunny day, said.
When are you going to stop using homeopathy as an example of bad science or bad medicine? It's obviously an easy thing to kick, so why not come on out to where we can have some real debate? Try to apply your claims of quack science to acupuncture. There is hard material there. You will not be able to laugh away. Don't be scared. Learning new things is good for you, even if it makes you look bad.
Thanks, it's a sunny day. We will stop attacking homeopathy when homeopaths stop claiming that they are able to treat malaria. But for now, here are your thoughts on the rights and wrongs of circus animals. Adrian One Ace says...
Jan Creamer states that the circus working group was a waste of time and that we're back where we were 18 months ago. Not true. Accept it. This is the second report on circus animals in the UK. Both have come to similar conclusions. There is no scientific evidence to ban animals in circuses.
Rennie Woods takes a different point of view.
I agree with Miss Creamer. One expects to see wild animals performing in countries where no animal protection laws exist. Certainly not in the UK, where we should be setting an example rather than endorsing animal abuse.
And finally, Andrew Cooper on the Facebook group couldn't find us last week.
This week's podcast didn't have album or artist tags, so even though I've transferred it to my MP3 player, I couldn't find it when I tried to listen to it in the gym this evening. Too dark for cycling on the towpath by then.
Bobby, what went wrong?
A technical glitch which will be fixed by the time you're listening to this wonderful podcast.
Apologies.
But if anyone missed it, go back and have a listen.
Apologies, one and all. Well, we're nearly at the end of the show, but I just want to bring our guest, Chris Turney of Exeter University, in one more time. We were talking about climate change there. Of course, a lot of the evidence for climate change comes from looking at past climate records. That's something you know quite a bit about.
But yeah, it's good fun, actually. You can learn a lot from the past. And one of the challenges we face is trying to keep the world's average temperature from rising by about 2 degrees centigrade. So we can never look in the past and see where it's even got close. And if we went back about 130,000 years, the way the Earth was orbiting a sun meant that the Arctic was getting a lot more heat. And the world's average temperature then was about 1 degree centigrade warmer than today. But in the Arctic, it was about 5 to 6 degrees centigrade warmer during the summer. Sea levels were 4 to 6 metres higher than today. So there's a lesson there, and 2 degrees doesn't sound a lot, but it is.
Well, let's see what happens in Bali. Maybe there'll be some progress there. Thanks, Chris. That's all we've got time for, I'm afraid, this week. If you want to comment on anything we've discussed, go on, don't be a stranger. The blog is there and ready and waiting. Thanks to Bobby Johnson and Ian Sample for their style and grace, and also to our special guest, Chris Turney. On the dials this week was Scott Cawley. I've been James Randerson. Abianto.
Guardian Unlimited.